Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Hello? Hello? We're almost there.
Hello?
Alright. Hey, long time no hear.
Yeah, how you doing?
Doing well. Super excited to hear you again.
Yeah, I'm alive. That's about it.
Oh man, I hear you.
Yeah, we're a couple minutes early yet anyway, so.
Well, I'm going to start recording about 30 seconds. No, actually, right now.
Okay.
And good evening, everyone. Welcome to a special edition Thursday night here, Wednesday night, excuse me, here at Your Remedy is in the Law. Tonight, of course, we're pleased to bring back an information provider from some of our past shows, returning again, very excited, on the subject of credit cards, Mr. Michael Maris. My name is Martin. I'll be your host for this evening's conference brought to you by Your Remedy is in the Law, which is in direct affiliation with Americans Restoring America. Before we get started with this evening, though, it is very important that I provide you with the following disclaimer. Nothing that you hear on this call tonight may be deemed by you in any way, shape, or form to be legal advice. If you are on this call because of a situation in your life where you require legal advice, I very politely ask you to hang up the phone. Now, we don't mean to sound rude when we say this. We just want to express to everyone in no uncertain terms that anyone joining this call looking for legal advice has no place or business here. Nobody here at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the programs offered by Americans Restoring America is a lawyer, attorney, or any member of the bar. Therefore, no one here is able to offer you any legal advice. Should you require legal advice, my advice to you would be get an attorney. As for these calls, they're all just for entertainment purposes. It's just folks saying what they might do were they similarly situated to you. You might get a little bit of education out of it, but mainly you're just going to get folks' opinions about what they might do. However educated and experienced these thoughts and opinions might be, they are just people's opinions nonetheless. And it's always up to you to do your own due diligence. All right, on to the next subject. I'd like to go over a few things here with Your Remedy is in the Law, if I could, very quickly. First of all, if I can take everybody to the homepage of www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com, we look up in the upper right-hand corner, we see a little picture of the Constitution. Click on that, and you'll have a separate page come up with just two items on it. These two items are of much importance, though, especially if this is all new to you. First and most importantly on the left is the jurisdictionary course. This is your 24-hour crash course on the Rules of Civil Procedure, better known to some as American Jurisprudence or AMJUR. The Rules of Civil Procedure are essentially the foundation or structure upon which all law in America rests. So to have a firm and thorough understanding of these rules means to have at least a basic understanding of what's going on and virtually any court scenario that you find yourself in. On the right is the common law default process, mostly known for its high national win rate in most traffic cases throughout the country. At least that's what it's most popularly acquired for. But that is not really why it's on this page. The reason that we have it up here with the jurisdictionary course is when you go through it, you'll notice that it utilizes a lot of the same fundamental procedures that you learned about in the jurisdictionary course, so it kind of acts as a real-life homework assignment. Also, for a lot of folks, it's their first time committing to action. Folks seem a little more willing to take that first step, probably because of such a high success rate and traffic scenarios being such a common interest in this country today. The common law default, although known majorly for traffic purposes, has many other. Truly, it's for most scenarios that you may find yourself in where there's no damage to property or person. It's just some entity is claiming you broke a rule, therefore you must pay a civil penalty. Both of these items are very affordably priced, the jurisdictionary with a contribution of $250 and the common law default at $150. Also on the subject of your remedies in the law, most of you are probably familiar now with Americans Restoring America. Every time you visit the homepage of yourremediesinthelaw.com, you are met with that blue box that pops up asking if you'd like to continue on to the site that you were visiting or stay and visit Americans Restoring America. The reason that we've done this is very simple. We're trying to get folks to explore. There are multiple information providers talking about multiple subjects, as well as many other features and study groups at Your Remedy is in the Law. And Your Remedy is in the Law is just one of a couple dozen websites that altogether make up Americans Restoring America. So there's quite a bit for you to see, and we hope that you'll do just that at your leisure. If you have any questions about whether or not we have an information provider that could give you their personal educated opinion about your particular situation, get a hold of us at yourremediesinthelaw.com, and we'll be happy to assist you in any way that we can. Statewide communications. If you're not already a member, please do sign up. Tell your friends and family about it. That's that map of the United States that you see on virtually every site that we have. It's a private communications platform that enables folks to speak with one another on a local level based on a very strict, pre-decided topics of discussion. Essentially, how it works is this. A wizard will walk you through a very easy setup. You know, put your name in here, click next. Put your zip code in here, click next, that sort of thing. Then it will walk you through the remainder of the setup. And then you'll get to a point where it will ask you, what are your hot points? What are you interested in? This could range anything from credit card issues, home foreclosure, IRS matters, asset protection, or maybe veterans' rights, maybe personal health rights. Anything that you can think of. And if it affects your personal rights in one way or another, you should find it in that list or something that's close enough. When the setup is complete, it puts it all together, much of how you think of a social network, though nothing like a social network. It's very custom. It's very private. But it then puts you in contact with people in your local area that have similar interests to you. The idea here is to put the power of education and communication back in the hands of the common man. If you are in need of legal advice or you need someone to represent you, you're going to have to get an attorney. It's just that simple. But if there was a way, a private place that you could go to discuss matters, your personal opinions, their personal opinions, with people that were like-minded, maybe you jump online one day and you say, this happened to me today. First person comes back and says, well, I disagree with that. I don't think they should be able to do that. I don't think that's fair. Well, that's probably not going to be of a tremendous amount of help to you. Well, maybe the next person comes on and says, well, I'll tell you what I would do were I similarly situated. I'd watch these YouTube videos, and then I'd go down there to my local county courthouse, go to the law library, get a law dictionary, and look up these terms. Maybe the next person after that says, those all sound like great ideas. I'd also go to this particular website and check out these educational materials that might assist you in your learning. I mean, for you to go and do some due diligence on what you're reading, just people's suggestions, people's opinions at all. But if you did some due diligence and educated yourself, maybe the farther you got into it, you discovered that it's not as difficult as you initially thought it would be because you're focused on one single subject. And you get to a point where you've educated yourself, and now you're handling your own affairs, your own matters. Well, folks, there's nothing illegal or unlawful about that. And that's all we're trying to do here at Statewide Communications is just very simply get people to start talking again. Of course, there's no cost to you for using Statewide Communications, either signing up or the regular using of it. And so we hope that you'll pass that around. Freedoms Radio. If you're over the road, you don't want to deal with the call process, maybe you're just new to your remedies in the law and you don't yet have your username and password, therefore you can't see the phone number and the PIN. By the way, if you'd like to pick up a membership to your remedies in the law, it's very easy. You just simply click the register button, fill out your basic information there. You'll enjoy the first 30 days for free to evaluate it. After that, it converts to a very affordable $10 a month on your credit card or your PayPal. But every single call is recorded. You have years of archives to go through, a vast wealth of knowledge, as well as many other wonderful features. But if that's not an option for you today, you have freedomsradio.com. Every night the calls go out over the air at 9 p.m. Eastern live. There's also the question bar there where you can type in a question, click submit. As long as that's during call hours, that will pop up on the moderator screen, and we do our best to read every single one of those questions out over the air as long as they are appropriate. So you don't get the one-on-one with the information provider like you would be by being a private member, but you do get your questions answered. There's no cost to utilize Freedoms Radio, so no matter where you are or your circumstances, you never have to miss a call again if you don't wish. All right, winding down here, I'd like to go over one last bit of housekeeping. This is your caveat emptor, or your buyer beware. For any purchase that you may make at Your Remedy is in the Law or any of the other sites underneath the umbrella of Americans Restoring America, when you come aboard and you go with an information provider, you are doing just that. Information providers pay Mr. Edward for advertising at Your Remedy is in the Law. This payment would be an expense to that information provider along with any other expenses that they might have associated with your particular product or service. When you contact us, all we simply do is listen to your particular scenario, quickly deduce from a list of folks that honestly most of you would probably never be able to find on your own just simply because they can't be found. And we make those introductions. Not every part on the information provider is always going to be successful. Everybody always hopes for the best. We plan for the best. And believe you me, we aim for the best. But unavoidable things do sometimes happen. And when they do, you have to roll with them and deal with them as you would with anything else in life. Again, we also want to emphasize, though, that the intent is always to be successful. If you have any questions of that, we welcome you to visit www.yourremedyisinthelaw.com/testimonials and see what others have to say about these products and services. Now, let's touch very quickly on the subject of refunds or the refund policy. There is none. Not at Your Remedy is in the Law, anyway. Of course, when you come aboard and you go with a particular information provider, again, that is exactly what you're doing. So any discussion of a refund or a credit would be a strict and private matter between you and the information provider, and even then, that's very few and far between. It must be extenuating circumstances. You are expected to have done your due diligence before you commit to any particular process or information provider's time. All right, lastly, pertaining here to all of the information providers at Your Remedy is in the Law, we'd like you to remind everybody that all of our speakers at these conferences are our guests and should be treated with the highest level of respect. If you disagree with something that a speaker has to say, that's fine. Disagreeing is how we learn, but please, you must always be civil. Besides, if a question is posed properly and then answered properly, then we can all learn something from it.
Well, Martin, thank you very much for that disclaimer. It's greatly appreciated. Ladies and gentlemen, to those of you listening that are employees, as an employee, you have a lot of taxes that are taken out of your paycheck. And as an employee, you're forced to participate in Social Security and some other things as well as an employee. How would you like to be, instead of an employee, a worker, where there are no taxes taken out and your future is determined by you and how you invest and what you invest in and so forth? How would you like to be a worker instead of an employee? Well, that's entirely possible if you are a worker for an LLC that the company that you formerly were an employee of now hires as a LLC providing services for that company. And in doing so, you'll actually bring home more money and you'll be able to take that money and better plan your future. If you're an entrepreneur and you are operating a business, regardless of the number of different opportunities you have to operate your business through, be that a proprietorship, a partnership, an LLC, an S-Corp, a full corporation, and all the other little opportunities that you have to operate through, depending on what your accountant would tell you is the best for your circumstance. How would you like to operate through an LLC that has no tax trappings and liabilities associated with it? That's what you're going to hear tonight. That's what you're going to listen to tonight. And so without further ado, it's my pleasure to turn the call over to Mr. Slevin, and let him share with you what we're doing. Go ahead, Mr. Slevin. Where'd he go? What happened? Well, it seems like he's got his call dropped. He was just there a second ago. I'm going to go ahead and try to bring him in, if I may. It'll only take a moment. There we go. Seconds.
Well, hello. Is there anybody there?
See you there. Welcome back.
I can blame that one on fat fingers. Thank you very much.
You've got them too?
Oh, my gosh. Well, anyway, how y'all doing today?
Doing well. I don't know where you heard me leave off at, but basically what I
just
shared was
when you said that it was, you would turn it over to me, and I reached up to hit the mute button and hit the wrong button, and it went away. So I'm here.
Okay, so you heard it all. Excellent. So we're looking forward to have Mr. Slevin mansplain things to us, because I'm going to enjoy this. Go ahead.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome to this evening's talk. So we're going on about 3 months worth of these things, and so we've explained over and over again how everything works out and how the history behind what we do and all that good stuff, and all those are now archived. So if you're interested in how that works, see, because I have this possibly annoying character trait, I really love to be right, and so that was the main reason behind making sure that everybody understood that it wasn't me saying these things. It was the Supreme Court. It was Congress. It was whoever, the founding fathers, that gave us all this foundational stuff. So, again, that is archived. You can contact your remedies in the law for those kind of things. So what is our company? What does our company do? We create what's called a private firm. And this comes, again, from the Supreme Court case Flint v. Stone Tracy, which specifically said that private firms are not subject to the income tax, a.k.a. not liable for, a.k.a. immune from. So what is a private firm? Well, they can take several forms, but we base ours on a limited liability company. A limited liability companies, which were first legislated in 1977, are a combination of the traditional corporation and statutory partnerships that have, and also common law partnerships that have been around for centuries. So the first thing that we do is we go and once we've decided upon a name with a client, then one of our personnel goes to the Secretary of State of New Mexico Why New Mexico? Well, I'll tell you in a second. But anyway, the goes to the Secretary of State of New Mexico, and they fills out a thing called the Articles of Organization. This is the application to form or organize a limited liability company under the statutes written by the New Mexican legislators. So once that is filled out and the Secretary of State issues a certificate of organization to our company that filled out the articles and says, okay, this is like the birth certificate for the company, and it says you can now go and do business under the name, under this name, and because you are in good standing, that's quote, in good standing, end quote, which is the way that the legislators describe a company, corporation, or partnership that has met all the proper requirements, and it is alive and viable. It is in good standing. So the once that we receive that certificate of organization, back to the Articles of Organization a second. So in New Mexico, there are a minimum of two parties required upon to be put upon the Articles of Organization. They are the organizer and the registered agent. Now, they did a really cool thing in New Mexico. They allowed the organizer and the registered agents to both be other LLCs, other limited liabilities company. Just a few thoughts on that. You could see how this can be backed up where an LLC owns an LLC, which owns an LLC, which is a registered agent for the LLC, and so on. So the organizer, if nothing else is filed with the Secretary of State, it is presumed to be the owner. And because it's only one, it is a sole member owner. Limited liability companies are owners, are known as members, and they own percentages of membership. But you can take that out to as far as many decimal points as you want. So you could have the company, the limited liability company, can have as many members as it desires. So the, excuse me, so the Articles of Organization have the organizer, which in our case is an LLC, and the registered agent, which is another LLC under our family of companies. And one of these is headquartered in Alamogordo, New Mexico. The other is headquartered in Raton, New Mexico. And between those two, we cover all the bases that the legislators described for doing this kind of work. So most every state of the union, all of the several states, have legislation to create or organize limited liability companies. However, places like Delaware and Nevada, which are usually used for this kind of thing, possibly Wyoming, when you go down there and try to get an LLC or corporation or whatever, they require people's names on these things, on the Articles of Organization or Articles of Incorporation. And these is known as the nominee list, right? So and this can be one or more people, but there is a list. Now, Delaware, Nevada, and so forth protect it, but it's still there. In New Mexico, it doesn't exist. You can't find something that doesn't exist. So once we get the certificate of organization, we bring it back to the office. This is all digital, by the way. We used to have to mail paperwork in, but thanks to COVID, we don't have to do that anymore. So we bring in the certificate of organization, and then one of our workers who has never filed a 1040 U.S. individual income tax return goes to the IRS website and petitions and then acquires employer identification number for the new LLC. The employer identification number is a form of tax identification number, which is the Social Security number that most of you out there possess, is another form of tax identification number, or 10. So the when our worker goes down and gets on the internet, at that point in time, he petitions for this EIN as the sole member, because they used to let one LLC get the EIN for another LLC, but that changed in 2017. So now you have to have a human with a Social Security number. But if this human has never filed a 1040, they are without the jurisdiction of the IRS. So there's there are multiple questions on the IRS website when getting an EIN. And one of them is, why is the LLC requesting an EIN? So there's about five or six answers, and the middle one is one we always choose, and it says, for banking purposes. And the subheading says, select this option if the reason for applying for an EIN is strictly to satisfy banking requirements or local law, period. Do you hear anything about taxes in there? No, because Section 701 of the Internal Revenue Code says the partnership as such shall not be subject to the income tax imposed in this chapter, period. The term partnership is defined way over in 7701 and says, in part, a partnership includes an unincorporated organization. And what piece of paper did we first get? Well, that would be a certificate of organization. So the term partnership in Section 701 means a limited liability company, and it means it's not subject to the income tax. Therefore, they have to give this option for getting an EIN for banking purposes only. So once the worker makes applies for the EIN and it's issued, and he is known as the sole member at that time, the sole member then holds a meeting of the company and forms a resolution, and that resolution commissions a manager for the limited liability company. Now, manager is the only officer of a limited liability company. Corporations have things like president, CEO, directors, and such. Statutory partnerships have limited partners and general partners. But the only officers of a limited liability company is a manager, but you can have as many managers as you wish. And you can put any kind of name in front of it, like chief executive or bottle washing manager or office manager, whatever, it doesn't matter. But the word, it must be, the office must be a manager. So upon commissioning the manager, then the individual who applied for the EIN does another resolution returning the sole membership to our organizer, and then we move forward. All right. So then the manager takes his commission, which is also known as a letter of authority, and the certificate of organization and the EIN papers down to a brick and mortar bank that we contract with, and gets the new company, the new LLC, a checking account. And there can be more than one of these. So everything I'm saying can be multiples and layers, and I'll give you a little bit of example of how those layers can protect folks in just a little while. So the with this new checking account in hand, which comes with electronic banking and debit card and all the bells and whistles that a typical business checking account comes with, we bring it all back to the office, and we pair it up with a pay-as-you-go cell phone. All right. The reason we're here again, we're using pay-as-you-go, is to eliminate any contact or any contract that may hold the client's name and numbers. So everything we do is built for privacy and anonymity. So that phone is programmed up with the electronic banking of the brick and mortar bank. We also include Square App and Cash App as a basis. This is kind of the Model T our base model of everything here. The Square app is a point of sale, so that can be connected directly to the bank account, so the new LLC can take debit cards and credit cards, and it go directly into the company account. And or it can be a secondary checking account with Square app can be established, and it has a debit card too. So that gives you two layers of checking, and Square also offers savings accounts. So you can have all these multiple layers, and so your eggs are not all in one basket. And Cash App is a peer-to-peer transfer platform that we, when we put it on the phone, we use it to pay some of the people out of the now company funds in the process of getting this all done. Cash App now also offers a debit card and a checking account, and they have multiple places which you can add money to or whatever. And giving a third way of moving money and selling goods and services. So the we put all this together, and we have a – it's up to about 16 pages now. It's called the operations procedures, in which all of this stuff I just laid out is covered, plus how to deal with the world this way. All right, so then we put it all together, make sure everything works, ship it off to the customer in a box, and they literally open up the box, fire up the cell phone, and do a little reading and figure it out, and then they can do business anywhere in the world income tax free. So that's the basis of what we send out. Here again, it can be multiplied. So at that point, when at the point of the client opening up the box, it is a small business, and this allows for the customer to sell widgets and or services, take payments under the company umbrella, under the company name, and then take payments via debit card, credit card, check, cash is, of course, always good. Square app happens to have a very good accounting section, so you can run everything through there. Of course, you don't have to worry about any kind of taxes because this limited liability company is income tax free. Now, what that means is, in other words, immune from the income tax. But what that means is, not only don't you ever have to pay any taxes, you don't have to do all this other stuff like keep receipts, you know, write down your mileage, write down, you know, how much you pay somebody to do something for the company. All of this is non-existent. You don't have to do it. Now, it's a very good idea, if you're going to run a business, to keep the books of that business so that as you build it and it gets up to being a very worthwhile business, then there are other corporations, institutions, and so forth out there that are always looking for thriving small businesses, and they will pay you a lot of money for that, but only if they can confirm the value, and the only way to confirm the value is by keeping the books. All right, so that is with a single LLC. Now, the transference from the organizer, who is listed on the Secretary of State's books as the owner, that transfer is private. It can be transferred to an individual, a human being, or it can be transferred to a pair of charitable religious trusts, and they can step in as an actor. So that just builds one more set of works, and then the CRTs have been confirmed to not be taxpayers, so they can't be charged in any way with it. And so you have the LLC as the interface with the business world. Because if you were to go into a bank and say, hey, I want a checking account for my trust, they're going to kind of cock their head and look at you sideways because they don't really understand trust, and there's a whole lot of information and disinformation out there about these things. But in the business world, everybody knows what an LLC is and how they work for it. So we often refer to our product, the private firm, as a an commercial interface between the CRTs or the client in its personal private context and the business world. Saying that, you can have multiple LLCs. And so just this the price for this setup is $7,500. And I believe the CRTs are about 1,000 apiece. Michael can correct me on that later. Nonetheless, the that sets up a nice small thing. But now, say you had a business that was grossing over $500,000 or something in that range, which made it more attractive for nefarious people to come and try to take it, which also includes its release, Satan, or IRS for short. So, and I learned this a long time ago. So we're talking, we'll use this in this example, we'll use a dentist. Now, so the dentist has his license and he has his medical license to do dentistry. And he has a practice by which he conveys and fills people's teeth, whatever. So the practice is the heart of this, and the dentist obviously is the one doing the work. So, but in order to do the work, he has to have equipment, like the dental chair and the drills and so forth. He has to have helpers, usually, like the front office staff and the dental hygienist and that sort of thing. And then he has to have a building to put it in. And so all of these components can be sectioned out under a separate LLC. And so it comes about something like this. So the dentist is practicing. Now he is covered from litigation by his malpractice insurance. All right. So the equipment, and we're going to say the practice is running under LLC A. Now, although the equipment is owned by LLC B, and it rents back to A, all of the equipment, as I said, the chairs and so forth, then LLC D holds the people that work for him, okay, or work for the practice, I should say, and they so they're the hygienists and the secretaries and so forth, and they are all paid and interfaced under LLCD. Now, the building itself can then be owned by LLCX, and LLCX rents the building back to the practice. And now the dentist may also have a home, and so he would have like LLC Romeo as the owner of the home, and so that in the event he was sued or the practice was sued, then and they got a judgment, they could only get what his insurance would go after. They couldn't get his home because it's titled in another LLC. They couldn't get the equipment because it's titled in another LLC. They couldn't get the building because it's titled in a secondary LLC. And all the workers are sitting there going like, oh, you can just go and leave me alone because I don't work for the practice. I work for this secondary LLC. Now, that is a complex setup, but it's all based on the initial one. And if you were in a situation like that, then we could work out, it would not be $7,500 for each of the LLCs. We would do a package deal to set all that up. All right, so that's a small business setup. That's a complex business setup. Now, estate planning, a lot of people out there and the trust are very good about holding the estate, but having the LLC can also do this by itself. You can, we'll say, you've got 20 pounds of gold, and a house on a, you know, on a good sized lot, and a car and a boat. And that's what you, what's considered the titled assets, other than the gold, titled assets within the estate. So all of these can be moved into, the titled assets can be moved into the LLC's name, and that's usually done by something like, called a quit claim deed at the local county recorder's office. So that's all put in there. Now, how do you transfer that? Well, the beneficiaries, by the way, the client, upon opening the box with the new LLC in it, the client will find a piece of paper, a letter, a commission or a letter of authority commissioning him or her as the manager of that new LLC. And so they can do business in that, function. So in the estate world, once the estate is established under the LLC, then it can also do the paperwork, the resolution to make the proposed beneficiaries as managers. So upon the demise of the primary manager, then the secondary managers just pick up, and because they already have the their commission letters in place, and then the primary manager would, you know, give them written instructions as to what to do with the LLC's estate or LLC's assets, so that upon the initial manager's demise, then the beneficiaries could just pick it up and go. What that, because these LLCs are done in perpetuity, which means forever, so they can't die, and the beneficiaries just commence doing business and or using the assets or whatever the primary would give them in written instructions. This eliminates probate and it eliminates estate taxes. So that's a nice easy way of doing an estate planning. Here again, the more complex, the more may be necessary for the situation. So that's the business side of it. Okay. And Michael mentioned earlier, what do you do with a W-2? Now, I'm sure you're familiar with a W-2 form, which is part of the third-party reporting that the IRS as a point man requires from every employer-employee relationship. So the first thing you want to do is understand that all business is contractual, right? And the contract makes the law. So when you're talking about an employer-employee relationship, you're talking about usually a human being who has contracted with a company, LLC, corporation, or another individual to do some function. They fix computers or whatever. Upon that contract, the employer, and an employer, by the way, employer and employee are defined within the Internal Revenue Code. So you have to look up those definitions. And just as a throwback to our earlier ongoing explanation of thing, if you look in, and I believe it's 7701 D, you find, A20, that's it. You find the definition of employee, and it's about 125 words long. It basically says that an employee is a full-time life insurance salesman. So just in case the rest of you thought you were employees. Nonetheless, so the contract of employer-employee defined by the Internal Revenue Code and so forth and so on creates a third-party reporting. Now, in the income tax world, the IRS is the first party. The quote-unquote taxpayer is the second party. And anybody that hands the taxpayer money is the third party. And they report to the IRS that money that changes hands via W-2s, typically an employer-employee relationship, and 1099s, 1098s, K1s, and there are several other smaller ones out there. So, and there's a whole bunch of different 1099s, by the way. So what we do once the employee receives one of our private firms and reads the operations procedures, then they can go to the employer and say, hey, how would you like to cut your labor costs for me by 25%? Now, that's going to get their attention right off the bat. So how do we get this 25%? Well, there's this thing called the burden rate. The burden rate is the bottom line cost of an employee to an employer. It is typically 1.5 to 1.6 times the salary of the employee. So, you know, we'll say this is Joe working for IBM, for an example. And he goes to his boss and says, hey, boss, how'd you like to save 25% on my services? And he says, okay, great. So what does that mean? So you say, well, I know because of the burden rate, you know, and we'll say that to use round numbers, that Joe is making $100,000 a year. That I know that according to the burden rate, and my salary is $100,000, but it's actually costing you $160,000 over the year's time, plus a whole lot of paperwork. So what we'd like to do, instead of me being an employee, we're going to substitute in this limited liability company as the contractor, and I will be the performer. I will do the same job, the same reporting, the same everything, same great service that you're used to, except every month, instead of figuring out, okay, my 8,000 and change minus taxes and all this other stuff and all this paperwork and benefits and so on and so forth. So instead of that, IBM is going to write one check to this limited liability company for $10,000, and then the limited liability company will take care of all of the beneficiaries and benefits and insurance and taxes and whatever else that you normally do. And so that $10,000 a month, of course, adds up to $120,000 over the year. So your bottom line cost for my services goes from 160 to 120, which is roughly about 25%. And you get and you get no paperwork other than the one 1099, which will be cut and go to the limited liability company and to the IRS. Okay? Most bosses are going to go, yeah, let's do that. So, again, because of the terror instilled by It's Really Satan, you know, some of this negotiation, but we have this concept. We have had accomplished it for people within our organization and other clients, so we know it works. So that's the W-2 situation. To run back up to the small business for a second, we also provide a W-9 format so that whatever business you're doing when you're dealing with a customer and they have been convinced that if they pay more than $600 to your small business run under the LLC umbrella, then they have to cut a 1099 and send it to the IRS and send it to the small business. So we provide the form, the 1099, with the proper names, numbers, and everything on it. And so that once you acquire our private firm and you start doing business with all these other things, you hand each of those people that require it a W-9 with the 1099, excuse me, with the TIN of the limited liability corporation, excuse me, limited liability company. So when at the end of the year, that particular customer will send the 1099 to the small business, the private firm, and to the IRS. The IRS gets it, looks at it, and goes, oh, that's nice, and literally throws it in the trash can because they have no place to settle it with because the limited liability company is not subject to the income tax. It's really that simple. So we covered the W-2 situation, the estate planning, small business, and complex business setups. So that's a real quick and dirty way that this private firm can be interfaced into whatever, and we call it a business model. So whatever you're doing today, the the business model. That's called a business model. You get ours. It's brand new. It's totally independent of your circumstance or anybody else's. And all business done under it is income tax free. That's a quick and dirty. I can't think of anything else right now that I'd say. So, hey, what are your questions?
All right. We're going to start with pressing star 2 on your keypad to raise your hands, ladies and gentlemen. Press star 2 on your keypad. That's the little icon underneath the number 7 of your dial. And then of those of you on Freedom's Radio, you'll see to the center right of your monitor the silhouette of a rectangle laying on its side. It's empty. Well, left-click inside of it and begin typing out your comment or question. Underneath, you'll see a place to put your name and then some other information if you like, and then press submit, and then I will give voice. It'll pop up on my end, and I'll give voice to your comment or question. Ron is first. Sam follows up second. But before you guys do, I'm sitting here listening to Mr. Slevin like it's the first time I ever heard him. And Wait a minute. I'm not making fun of you.
I know. I find humor everywhere.
It's like the guy that reads the Bible, and then he's read it 5 times, and on the 5th time he found something he never saw before. It's every time you read it, every time you hear it, something else comes out. And I'm looking at 2 people on this board here that I recognize as having employees. I at one time had 9 employees, and of those 9 employees, when I refer to them, those are all the full-time people that worked for me, that worked for me forever. They died of old age. They didn't leave. I'm serious. The people I started with are the same people I ended with, except those that died. That was it. I had another group of people that were basically part-timers, or they were working full-time, but, you know, if they left, it was okay with me. I wouldn't have been upset. They were actually alleviating some of the burden on my key people. Had I had it to do over again, and I understood what Mr. Slevin's program was about, I would have paid and given them their own LLC to work through that I could pay. Now, you remember that there's this thing called an independent contractor. We were always looking to find some way to make somebody an independent contractor so that we could pay them directly and not have to deal with the BS of all the different taxes. We could just 1099 them out the door. But you couldn't do that because the IRS would visit you and they'd go over your books and say, do you bring your own tools in? Yes, as a matter of fact, I do. Do you set your own hours? Can you come and go as you please? Well, no, I have to be here while the store is operating. You're not an independent contractor then. If I had these people, I'd be saving myself a ton of money if first I let them season out as employees so that the insurance that I had to copay with them when they left, they would, you know, as an employee, they can take their insurance with them. And there was a point where you couldn't in the old days, but then in the not-so-old days, they passed a law so that if you had an insurance company, you could keep the premiums up and so forth. I'd let them season, and then I would pay for them, have this LLC. I'd be doing everybody a world of good. I'd be doing myself a world of good as the former employer because I'd be saving a bucket load of money, and there'd be parts of it that I wouldn't be telling them about so that extra 50% difference was not going to go anywhere. It would have been that's a little bit – wouldn't have been 50%. It would have been a lot less. And then they would have earned more money than what they were making from me at that time. And they had all this opportunity then to, you know, do their own thing. So I'm saying to the particularly the 2 people on this call right now, I think each one of you know who you are. that you might want to think about those long-term permanent employees of yours that are going to be there long after you've taken your last breath, paying for their LLC or offer them 50-50, whatever, but getting them into the LLC program so that you don't have to mess with that part of your bookwork and you get to save money. Have I hit some things, Mr. Slevin, that resonate with you?
A perfect idea.
I love it. I love it. All right. So, Ron, let me unmute your phone, then followed by Sam, then followed by Mike in Lost Wages. Go ahead, Sam. Ron.
Two questions. One, the member LLC, do they have to be 50-50, or could they be 25-75?
No. It can be anything that is done by contract. All business is negotiation. Whatever you want to do, you just got to negotiate it.
Yeah, just wanting to clarify that. Also, you were talking about setting up additional LLCs. Now, is each additional LLC $7,000, or is there a less expensive?
No. No. That's the comment I made was, if your situation was what we described as a complex business setup, and we wanted to do with, you know, one LLC owns the building, one LLC takes care of the workers, one LLC runs the practice. So all of that, you know, that would be a negotiated thing. We would take a look at it. We'd sit down and we'd talk and we'd figure out, okay, what is the present business model look like? How can we best do that? And then it would, you know, I mean, these things, depending on it, the actual cost of the separate LLCs would get down probably around $1,000 or less. But here again, it's all details. That's all negotiation. But you know,
your original $7,500, if that was for each LLC, would tend to be prohibitive. But that clarifies things.
So like as I iterated there, we build a base model with the individual, the LLC having one checking account and then the phone. Okay, so that's the initial components. Now, depending on the situation of the client, we can go, okay, well, that doesn't really cover you in this area, that area, and this area over here. So I would suggest, and by the way, I never give advice. I only make suggestions, and so does my people. And so we would suggest, okay, this would probably be better if we had this, that, and the other. And then we would figure out, okay, this, that, and the other, and then when it's put all together, then we'll have that, then we'll agree on a price and go from there.
Building a complete business plan.
Yeah. It's all details, but the details are just done through negotiation, you know, but the base model, and I don't know, I may have said this before, you know, this can be escalated to immense size because Daimler Chrysler, you know, the merger between Chrysler Motors and Daimler Engineering, I guess, is an LLC, and that's a huge conglomerate. So, you know, the base model is absolutely sound. It is income tax free, and then we can just layer it from there and build nothing but happiness throughout. Go ahead.
Okay, thank you. That clarifies a lot of things. That was reasoning for my question was for clarification.
Sure. You're welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ron. Any other questions, Ron? I know you said two, but you get a twofer here if you get four questions, if you like.
Well, not to belabor the point, but you're about 10 hours late on your return phone call.
Okay.
But we won't discuss that.
Oops. Well, Ron, if you want to know the truth, I forgot. Just totally forgot. And it's all your fault.
I kind of figured that, and I wound up having to go grocery shopping after all.
All right. Thank you, sir. Call me tomorrow, please. All right. Next is Sam. Go ahead, Sam.
So I just asked my employer to, is there paperwork that they have to?
Yes.
Okay. So how do I pose the question? Because I want to have my farm under an LLC, and I want to supply money for my farm through my labor.
Yeah.
So how do I pose the question to them? And can you walk me through it just a little bit better?
Yeah. The basis of business is contract, right? And contract makes the law. Okay, so right now the general situation is you have the employer and the employee. In this case, the employer is the farm, and you are the employee. All right, and if you're working under the traditional income tax rules, then the employer has to accept your services and pay you cash and then provide benefits. And out of that transaction, then they will withhold the Federal Income Contribution Act or FICA chunk of the change. And then they will withhold the income tax, which everybody thinks that they owe, and do all the paperwork to show that this happened, all right?
Yeah.
So once you were to acquire a private firm as the employee, then the private firm steps into the gap of where the employee sits now, and it becomes a employer company to employee company transaction. So the people are taken out of it, and it's a company to company contract. And within the contract, whatever you do, that's all spelled out. Okay. Here again, it's all about negotiations, all about contracts. And so once that contract, now, how do you approach the employer? As I said, you walk up to him, hey, boss, you know, you like what I do, right? You go, well, yeah, you do good. So how would you like to save 25% of my labor cost and get the same guy at the same great with the same great service and everything being the same, but you save 25% off the top of your labor cost? That's going to get his attention, because every business loves to have expenses go down and revenues go up, and this is exactly what you're doing. So that's it. Just start out. Now, here again, we've done this before, and we can assist in negotiations and setting up the contracts and all, you know, all of that stuff. And initially, this kind of integration from whatever your business model now is to integrate the new business model with a private firm, that falls under what we call our hotline services. All right, the hotline services is a subscription. It means it's optional, but it's free for the first year, and then it's $500 after that. But if you and so we assist in all this integration and all the details that we talked about with the last gentleman. So then the second year, the subscription is $500 and so forth and so on. Now, if you allow the subscription to lapse and then call in and say, hey, I need help with this, or I need the company to do that or whatever, they'll say, great, but since the subscription has elapsed, then it'll be $500 an hour, first hour up front, and then we'll make a determination of how much more time is going to be needed to do whatever you want to do. So that's how that works. What else?
And is it still legal for my employer to, because I'm a union operator, so they send so many dollars per hour go into a pension that's in my name and a benefit. Like, is that still okay, even though there's money that's
So the way the contracts that your employer has with unions and with these other, and the main thing is it's called benefits. It's a benefit package, okay?
Right.
So that's one of the benefits. So this benefit package would not be in vogue if it's a company to company contract.
Yeah.
So, but as I stated, you know, in my example, Joe was making $100,000 a year, and then and now once they redo it, he's making $120,000 a year. So if you look at your bottom line, and oh, by the way, that's not just 20%. Remember that FICA and income tax and so forth and so on takes roughly 40% of your take home. So out of that $100,000 that Joe is being paid, he's actually only taking home 60. So in our example, Joe went from making $60,000 to $60,000 to taking home $120,000. That's 100% markup. Could your 100% markup in your take home cover your insurance and benefits and pension and whatever else?
Yeah.
That's the kind of thing you have to make that decision of, and it's called a risk to reward matrix. And you figure, you know, run the numbers. If it makes sense, do it. If it don't make sense, well, I'd leave it alone. Go ahead.
All right. Okay, so just all I got to do on my end is set my LLC up and then get a hold of you guys?
Yeah. Yeah, once you make the decision to do that, then there'll be negotiation, and we'll talk about details. We'll talk about, okay, this is what you want to do.
Okay.
Fine. We need to make this, this, and this. Like I said, we have our operations procedure is a general guideline, and it's like 16
okay.
pages long, and it covers these kind of things. But then you have, as I said, the hotline services is free for the first year, and so we have an 800 number, then which you call up and you get an answer.
Okay.
How's that?
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Most excellent. Thank you, sir. Next is Michael, followed by Kent, followed by Ron. Go ahead, Michael.
Good evening. He mentioned employee when you fill out a W-2. Is that correct?
The W-2 is the third-party reporting filled out by the employer to show that they paid the employee and how much taxes and whatever else. That is a form, W-2.
Right. And the definition, because the employee has to sign it, and then the definition of employee is a insurance salesman. Is correct?
In the definition section in the Internal Revenue Code, which is Title 26 of the situation, Title 26 of the United States Code, the definition section, the main definition section is Section 7701. And I believe it's Section 7701A, A20, and which is 100-something words long. And when it all comes down to it, it says that the term employee includes a full-time life insurance salesman. And then they redefine employee to say that it's only what, excuse me, they redefine the word includes to say it's only what's in the list. So that's just one of the word salads that these guys do. Yeah, it is A20. I just went and pulled that up. So that's just all part of, like I said, all of this stuff is, in the archives, and you can listen to it, and it's a little over an hour long, and it tells you all of this stuff. So,
the includes part. Well, anyway, so every employer and every person that's filling one out, they're committing fraud.
No, they're not.
Because they're not insurance salesmen. See, I struck that out on my tax forms. I was putting. Section 83A, I'm not an employee, I'm a wage earner, and 83A is wages are not taxable according to their code.
That's true.
But now I use a W8 bin, and they don't even look at it anymore. Because
right.
I used to ride on the side, on top, on the other side. They're like, well, you can't do this. I said, well, this is a contract, and you're telling me I have to sign it. It's a contract, and that would get them right there. They couldn't stand that part. So
of
you want me to sign a contract. And but I use the W8 bin now, and there's just no discussion at all. They just send it, and they don't take any federal income tax out.
Yep.
So I was just wondering if that's, you know, because the way they word salad everything and it, and they're, they have to go back to, if you're not an insurance salesman, then what are you?
Right. Well, and there's multiple other things. As I remember it, it says in section 7701A20, a life insurance, a full-time life insurance salesman for the purposes of Chapter 21. Chapter 21 is where you have FICA, and there's a bunch of people that are not employees, and then there are a bunch of people that are employees, but it's all variation. But the main thing is it comes back to being a the officer of a corporation, which goes back to the 1909 Revenue Act, which shows that the income tax or the taxes on income is the income is the measure of an excise tax, and the subject of the tax is actually doing business in the corporate capacity. So, oh yeah, it's but yeah, get the archives and you can go over those, a couple of those, and I lay all that out.
Well, I will one day here. Right now I'm having a test to go into a refinery, so I've got multiple days of testing. But when I get time, I will, and I'd sure like to poke the bear with this one. Anyway, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Michael, I want to add some things to your comments or to the picture that's been painted here. If you operate through this LLC and if you have corrected your status, and if you've taken everything that you previously owned and gifted them these toys or these necessities into their individual trusts, you are truly enjoying the vision of our founding fathers for the life and the society that we were that we inherit by birthright. I wanted to share that. Kent, go ahead.
Yes. Good evening, Joe. I appreciate your talk on the layering effect of the LLCs, and I want to talk about this from two different points of view. One being the multiple LLCs and how a sharp attorney might be able to penetrate other than one, and also the second point that Michael was making earlier, when questions and answers started, about the employer paying for the LLC for the employee. So back to the first one, do you see a way or any way that a sharp attorney could get beyond the first LLC that was providing the services and somehow put a hook into, let's say, the equipment or the building or the actual employee? Absent a very, very tight contract for the customer who was coming in and obtaining those services. And I asked that question from the point of view of whether they're operating not only through an LLC, but possibly a PMA in providing certain services. So if you'd comment on that, I'd appreciate it.
Well, as I said, the state of New Mexico allows one LLC to own another, and that's what's on the public record. So we'll just make a use of an example. We'll say that the customer of the dental practice, you know, feels slighted and he wants to sue. He would go to a lawyer and go, hey, I want to sue Dr. So-and-so because he hurt my feelings, which in today's environment, unfortunately, is a possibility.
Could happen. what happened?
Yeah, exactly. So the lawyer would then say, okay, well, it'll be $1,000 up front because I got to research this guy and see if there's, you know, whatever. So he pays the initial fee, and then the lawyer goes and starts looking at what the dentist owns, all right, what's in his personal name, because that is his assets. And so he will find that the dentist does not own his house. The house that he lives in is owned by LLCA or whatever, and that's and the LLC out of New Mexico, and then he goes to the records in New Mexico and says, okay, well, LLCA is actually organized by this one company, and that's the end of it. That's where the public record starts. So he looks at this, okay, well, who owns this practice? It's this one LLC, and then he goes and looks, and one LLC was organized by two LLC, and two LLC was organized by three LLC. And so there's this layer, and it's nothing but LLCs, with nothing has the dentist's name on it. So he looks at all that and goes, okay, that's fine. Okay, well, let's look at his practice. And then so by hook and by crook, because this is private information, he's able to find that, oh, well, all the, all the people work under Joe's LLC, and all the building and the equipment are owned by other LLCs, which are owned by other LLCs, which are owned by other LLCs. So that's what the public record reflects. So even a very sharp attorney would take one look at that and go, this is about as judgment proof as you can be. So he would go back to the client who felt wronged or harmed and say, this would be a hard row to hoe, because you're going to have to sue the dentist himself, and he has little or nothing. So you might get something off the malpractice insurance if we were able to prove the case, but that would be the extent of it. Because once an individual gets a judgment, they are in charge of enforcing the judgment. The court doesn't do anything for that the plaintiff. And so he would have to go out there and he would have to dig down or pay to have somebody dig down through these layers after layers of LLCs on the public record to maybe get to it. And that's a lot of work. Lawyers don't like to work hard. So they would charge the plaintiff an immense amount of money to do this research. And unless they got a magic wand, they'd just say, this is not a worthwhile case. So that's kind of the way that looks from a legal standpoint.
Okay, so let me ask this
Wait a minute, yeah. Kent. Add to that this dentist example has taken every single piece of property that everyone else would refer to as that the dentist owns, which in truly he doesn't, because each property is in a trust, and the dentist himself is correct of his status, there physically is nothing to deal with. Because everything is in a trust, then a team member can be nominated as defender of the trust. He doesn't have to go out and hire a lawyer. He can hire one of the team members to come in and defend the trusts or the corporation's soul. And the first thing that he would be screaming upon litigation is jurisdiction of the court. Jurisdiction of the court is only for United States citizens, not for American nationals. And the only time that American national can be sued, if you would, not sued, but charged with a crime, let's just say that he stole or embezzled or something like that, is not in the civil courts, but in a true American common law court, a Seventh Amendment court. That's the only place that they can deal with them. And they don't go there. That house has the lights, it's the house is built, the lights are on, but nobody lives there.
Nobody home.
Nobody home. So this is really, the whole thing is just one total blanket on everybody's parade that wants to make money off of this dentist. Go ahead. Continue.
Yeah, so let me go back to what I originally raised with this part of the question. So do you get involved at all with the contract that the party, once they have this LLC set up, do you get involved without, you know, just naturally with the contract that the party would have with their quote-unquote customers that come in the door or their clients that come in the door, so that it's clearly stated? Because, you know, there's a lot of contracts out there where it's kind of sloppily stated who's really providing the services. So do you get involved with that to the point that this contract must be so tightly worded that clearly only that one LLC is providing the services, and that is another point at which, you know, they can't cross that line in addition to the privacy that's established in New Mexico?
Well, the way we normally do things is we build it all, we get it to you, and it's now your business. We actually provide a what we call a statement of non-interference, which says, mm-hmm. Hey, we built this really cool business model. It's now yours, and we don't touch it, interface with it, or anything like that without written instructions, all right? And then when it comes to contract, you know, contract and negotiations, as I said, that's part of the integration phase, and that does fall under our hotline services. However, that's not our business. Our business is to build this really cool business model. Now, you know, we assist and we make suggestions, but it's your business. If you want something that tight, then I would suggest going to somebody who that's their business and paying them. Because I have this
we'll
old adage. Old adage. I pay people for what they're good at. We are really good at this. Okay. And if there's somebody that's, you know, if you've got a particular thing, then we're going to be cool. Well, that's not our business. You know, we can maybe recommend somebody who might do something like that, you know, and hand off the name and number or whatever. But that's not our business. Our business is building these things and getting them integrated into your business model at this point.
Okay, thank you. Now, as part of that question, I would also ask, can you tell us how a PMA would fall into and work with this LLC if somebody wanted to have a PMA involved?
Well, a PMA is just another business model. I do not know about them. I have never worked with them. But I know that our business model, our private firms, are a great interface. And so the interface can be between a trust, between a PMA, between an individual, ad infinitum. Go ahead. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And the second question, what Mike was talking about, which I had thought about, whether or not it would pay the employer to buy these multiple LLCs for their different employees. Mm-hmm. On thinking about that some more, and I really haven't finished thinking about it, but I'm thinking about that some more, wouldn't that be better if we really reason this out? I mean, both parties are actually benefiting from that arrangement, but it would seem to me that it would be, and I'd be interested in your comments on this, not that they have to be definitive one way or the other, but it would seem to me that it would be better for an employee to approach their, let's say, CPA or their tax attorney, if they have one, and let them voluntarily set that up rather than the employer coming in there and setting it up. I don't know. That just seems to be, that company seems to be, those people keeping company seems to be a little too close for me. Do you find any validity in what I'm saying there with, you know, having the employee do it through someone who is licensed and certified within the system versus just the employer doing it for the employee?
No, because they are licensed and certified and accredited, and all that means is what they do with the IRS says, roughly. All right. So let me finish.
Okay.
So to answer that question, no. But now the actual transaction, regardless of who forks over the cash, would be between our company and these other individuals. We start out a negotiation with a thing called the application to purchase. The client makes application to us to purchase one of these public or private firms, all right? So there's negotiation there. And we have multiple, we accept multiple ways of being paid and so forth and so on. And this is all laid out in that thing. So, but, so we'll just to extend from your question. So we have an employer and he learns about this great thing called the private firms and how that can save him a whole lot of money. And, oh, he really loves his 10 employees. And so, you know, he'd like to set up the way of doing business that we talked about earlier. And so he would talk to us and we would say, okay, he says, okay, I want three LLCs to facilitate and protect my business. And then I want 10 LLCs for Joe, Mary, Bill, so on and so forth. And we say, okay, great. And so we'll go, that needs to be this, that needs to be that. How do you feel about this? So and so and so forth. Okay, that'll be, we'll throw something out there. That'll be $50,000. So the $50,000 would be instituted, and then each of the present employees would, they would get their own, but here again, all of this is formed under our company's names and numbers. And so the quote unquote employees, they would have the same anonymity and privacy using our product that the employer has when he starts out.
Mm-hmm.
And the cash would come into the coffers of, you know, and then we would set it up, you know, put all the slots in the right holes and everything like that. So that's, you know, that's a complex business structure. And, but everybody would be treated to the same anonymity and privacy as the initial person, because we really don't care where the cash comes from. Because we are fully convinced that we are sovereign. And that each man is rules himself, and so if you know whatever you want to do, and we'll hash it out, discuss it, negotiate it, come up with a way to do things, and if that price fits into your business model, let's go for it. What else?
Okay, so I understand what you're saying, but let me just go back to what I was saying. So. It is possible to find, and I know this from personal experience, people who operate within that system, be they CPAs or tax attorneys, who will mm-hmm. do things other than what the IRS tells them to do. Not because they're crooked, but they see a better way to do something or another way to do something. And as long as they conclude that it doesn't cause them to cross some line that they can't cross, which might create a problem with their certification or their license, or their professional associations, they will often do that. I like the idea of a reliance defense and using people within the system, because my personal experience is that sometimes that prevents problems down the road. But I hear you saying something a little different than that. So I'm not suggesting that the anonymity and what else you provide, the privacy that you provide, that there's anything wrong with the way you do it. I was just suggesting, could there be another layer there that makes this more efficient and separates the parties a little better? That was my point.
Yeah. If the employer would like a CPA that does whatever to deal with our company, well, we're all for it. I mean, you know, we'll deal with anybody. It's just a matter of, you know, how much do we want to do, and how much time, and how much money. We'll absolutely deal with them. I was just commenting that would not be necessary because of how our business model is already set up.
Okay. All right. Very good.
I want to jump on what you're saying, Kent.
Yeah.
I want to add to what you're saying, because you're what you're asking about is the next step, which is the golden horseshoe. If instead of let's say I'm the employer, I would say to the employee, I'm providing this for you. However, rather than you do this in your name, I would strongly consider that you invite you to get $2,000, get two charitable religious trusts, and have those two trusts create you know, this LLC, be the creators of it, 50-50 share. And once that's in place, then, you know, follow it through. When you can afford it, you get the two foreign grantor trusts that dovetail into these two CRTs. Those two foreign grantor trusts are the children of a parent foreign grantor trust, which is the creation of a private interest foundation in Panama, which sends all the money to a corporation soul in the United States. You have totally separated everything at every step of the way. There is no blowback. There's no way to have a blowback.
Well, and while you might make an argument that that's a feasible way to do it, and certainly the employee, if they were being paid in full and the burden, there was a less burden on the employer, they would have, essentially, they would have some funds that they weren't paying in taxes as an employee in order to do all this. But respectfully, sure, with regard to what you're saying, I don't think pragmatically that the average employee is going to understand all this or wants to make their life that complicated. I mean, we have to look at what's going on in the real world today.
I wasn't talking about the average employee. I said, and when I prefaced this to begin with, I said, mm-hmm, I had nine key people,
right,
that were paramount to me. Those nine I would have done this for. Now, I also, mm-hmm, had other full-time people that basically served these key people. And if and they're the ancillary people were there to learn the key people's job, so that, you know, either through expansion or the fact that something happened in their life, I'd have somebody that could slip in as well. But it wasn't for all the employees. It was only for my key paramount people.
Mm-hmm.
And yes, it would benefit them all the way around, because I'm teaching them, as not only their employer, former employer, but as their friend, because we were friends. So everything I do is always synergy. I wouldn't dare make a step that didn't profit anyone else that I was dealing with. I refuse not to let people I deal with make profit from my work. And that's because it's just the way I was taught to do business. It's my business model. If I keep Mr. Slevin with cash flow coming, and I'm the source of that, you know, he's got other sources, but I'm this source, and I'm doing this for him, you know, he's going to want to stay with me. And that's what my employees did. I didn't lose employees to other people. They stayed with me for 25 years.
Well, I get what you're saying, Mike, and I heard you very clearly say that you would do this for your very valuable employees, and the others, until they, right, were quote unquote seasoned, wouldn't necessarily be in that. But I'm thinking of an average, you know, man or woman who owns, you know, let's say an 8 or 10 employee business, relatively small business, who would like to change this all over, regardless of the status of those employees, and do away with all this bookkeeping and everything else and have everybody on this program. And I don't think that all of the employees pragmatically would go for the golden horseshoe and all of that. So I was looking at it from that point of view, how this could be done.
But they don't have to. They can survive very well with just what is on the table here tonight.
Yeah, okay, all right. I don't disagree. I was just throwing it open for some other thoughts. Cool.
We can do that.
All right.
Okay,
I believe before getting into a knife fight that I should throw some grenades your way.
Okay. Yeah, me too.
I don't disagree.
All right.
Okay.
Anything else, Kent?
No, that's it for tonight. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Ron, and then Mike again. Go ahead, Ron.
Yes. The LLC, can it be a lending agent?
The LLC can do anything you could do.
Okay. Be a private lender. My train of
anything
thought.
Anything
was,
you can do, it can do.
My train of thought was to set up a homestead community and be able to lend funds or.
Absolutely.
Properties or whatever to the outlying homesteads to get them on their feet and running.
Remember the example of Dalmer Chrysler. It can go that big. Anything you can do, it can do.
Oh, your company, your assistants, do you provide services? Never mind. My mind is wandering, and I can't remember what's
on it.
Next.
Huh? You put it on a leash.
Put a leash on it.
Put it on a leash.
Yeah.
Oh, concierge. Do you have a concierge service?
The hotline services gets into that.
It is your concierge. Okay. I thought that was the lead in on that, but I just wanted to verify. All right. Uh-huh. Thank you.
Sure. You're welcome.
All right. Thank you, sir. All right, Michael, take us home with your last question. I'm going to check Freedom's Radio, see if anybody's over here. Go ahead.
Well, I'll say with a concierge service, does that come with a limousine and dinner and a massage therapist?
Yes.
I got this
new massage therapist, and she also does horses. I have been really romped on.
Yeah.
Since you brought that up.
The reason that most people that are in the tax service business, small tax service business, not H&R Block, won't touch anything is because several years ago the IRS made them all sign an agreement. They had this contract with the IRS was if one of their clients came under the IRS's radar, that the IRS could then come in and look at all their clients with no safety net at all for their clients. So that's why most of them are real cagey about. Now, a CPA is different because he's part of the club. But the small tax specialists there that fill out W-2s and W-9, whatever,
preparers.
For people at the end, preparers, they're scared to death of the IRS. They're just total fear, and that's the way they want them.
Yep.
Yep.
Oh, you'll love this, and our company actually has a few clients that are tax preparers, and so this one person, she says, yeah, I want my LLC to be Yo No Sé, which is Spanish for I don't know. So we built her Yo No Sé LLC.
That's cool. So if I start the LLC, can I use like other crane operators, iron workers, pipe fitters?
The LLC can do anything that you can do.
Okay. So we could use that, each one of us.
Anything in business that you can do, the LLC can do. It's just it's a different hat, if you will.
Because if not, it doesn't really matter because once I show it to, I do it and I show it to them and how it works because they want to have somebody that's a sacrificial lamb first. They're too scared to move. and we're talking people that make $150,000, $250,000 a year. But,
yeah.
You know, everybody's scared of the IRS. So if I can show it to them, you know, there's 150,000 union iron workers. There's, who knows, tens of thousands, probably 200,000 operators and electricians.
That would just thrill my soul, brother. I tell you what.
The business model for you is there's so many people out there that, once they see it and they accept it, you know, somebody else has done it, they'll be right on board. Because that's all they talk about on these jobs is taxes.
Yeah. I know.
And they're all scared to death. I don't know why. I
mean, uh-huh.
just a thought.
Thank you, Michael. We have one more visitor raising their hands. Parts unknown, weight unknown. Totally everything is unknown about them. So just step forward and please introduce yourself.
This is Big Ed. Thank you guys for the evening, the information. Yes. Yeah.
Welcome, Big Ed.
I need to bite the bullet, the sacrificial lamb, and I need to do an automatic draft for you guys and set it up so I can be in your lineup, if you will.
You're talking
Michael,
about,
give him your phone number.
The Corporation Soul.
Yeah, I did. Yeah.
You're talking about from the emails that you sent me. Don't you have my direct phone number?
I was afraid to use it, sir.
Why? Do I bite?
Not hard.
All right. I got it.
No, please.
I'll do it.
And the number ending in 1234. Yeah, call me.
Yep. Thank you, sir. Thank you. I'll go.
All right. Thank you. All right. Anybody else? That's it. Otherwise, we're going to say goodnight. Press star 2 on your keypad. I'm going to go check Freedom's Radio real quick. Anything in closing that you'd like to add, Mr. Slevin?
Everybody have a bodacious day.
Thank you so much, sir. Good night, everyone. See you this Saturday. Until then, good night, everyone, and be well.
The conference is now completed. Goodbye. Welcome to the conference. Please enter the conference ID, followed by the pound key. Thank you. Guest ID accepted.
Thank you.